that you are, you know, discussing it with other people. So the another option is the Thursday afternoon, or well, Thursday podcast discussion group. It happens earlier in the day than this Tuesday class. So check that. It's on the Brightways End calendar, and anybody's welcome to attend. Usually this group, it's a small group that usually discusses my podcast episodes, but while we're studying the precepts, they're also going to study the precepts and go along like at the same rate that the Tuesday classes are. So, think that's everything. There is a 1-day retreat in March and another one in April, so you might want to look ahead and slot those times for you. Any questions about any of that, or things that I should announce, other things I should announce? Are you sure you don't want the
No, okay.
Okay. Okay, so very fascinating chapter, or two chapters. Oh, and one more precept thing. We will be using this book, Waking Up to What You Do by Diane Eshin Rosetto. And there's information about it on the website. And I'm going to encourage the people who are leading the classes to, at the very least, you know, read their relevant chapter and base their class on it. Not that there are many different there's four different precept books that I know of, and so people are welcome when they're leading classes to pull things in from other places. But this is a good this is the main thing we'll be using. So in Kyogen's book, which is You Are Still Here, this was the chapter on ancestors and the chapter on the lineage of women. So I'm just looking around, and I think most of you are familiar, but just in case not, I will review, give a brief background and review of the way that we hold the idea of ancestors and lineage in Zen. If you have come to Sunday chanting service, so it happens before Zazen and it's about a half an hour long, so we do several chants, but one of the things we do is recite the lineage of ancestors, all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha down through this list of names in India, and then this list of names in China, and a list of names in Japan, and then a couple lists of, you know, folks in the West. The idea is that lineage reflects the relationship from teacher to student. So it's Shakyamuni Buddha, and then he transmitted the Dharma to Makakasho, and then Ananda, and then that each of these it represents a relationship between a teacher and a student, and then, you know, from there on, teacher to student. And that they passed this tradition down to us, that we wouldn't have it if it wasn't passed down by these people. And particularly, it's more than just they taught them the scriptures and the ceremonies or whatever kind of trappings of the tradition, but that they passed down the real meaning of it, that they, you know, I guess in the idealized sense anyway, that each of these ancestors awakened in the way that we are aiming to awaken. And then they had a student, and then they recognized that student as having, you know, attained the same awakening and therefore can carry that. So sometimes it's called the transmission of the lamp. It's like a light that has been passed down. In when Kyogen describes it, on page 163, he said his teacher, Roshi Kennett, used to ask us every so often, who transmitted Shakyamuni Buddha? Transmission, particularly in the Zen tradition, is very important. Transmission follows a series of events. A disciple goes through the crucible of master-disciple relationship and is seen to have gone through it. They have experienced meditation practice and had what's called the turning moment, where your being is turned inside out. They are seen to cultivate and integrate all that. Correct transmission is really important in the Zen tradition. So if you find this whole thing curious, I did two whole podcast episodes on transmission. My Zen Studies podcast episodes 51 and 52. And I called it profound, practical, and mutable, meaning changeable, Dharma transmission in Zen. And I also did one called Lineage in Buddhism, that's episode 95, the intersection between the individual and the collective tradition. So I called that profound, practical, and mutable. So this is quite a rich part of our tradition. It has a profound aspect of practical, and I'll talk about both of those, but also mutable in the sense that there, I guess it's empty like everything else, right? It is a creation of human beings, and it has its purpose, but that does not mean it is a thing, you know, capital A, capital T, that has remained inviolate through the 2,500 years since Shakyamuni Buddha. It's something that is fluid. It's a human creation. It means different things in different settings. It's changed through time. So we shouldn't get too idealistic about it either. So just to talk a little bit about the profound aspect of it. So this is, you know, I mean, take this as myth, but also as myth, as in pointing to something that it may not be maybe literally true, but it's pointing to something that's very important. So I guess the ideal is that the student awakens to their own nature and integrates that in the sense that they haven't just had one flash of weird insight and then continued to, you know, live a kind of careless life. They've integrated the meaning of it. They've learned it. They can express it. And then they say Buddha meets Buddha. So it's like the teacher just recognizes this transformation in the student, and in that it's not something that you can easily just put words to or qualifications on. This is one of the tricky parts, for instance, of Soto Zen Buddhism in the West. We have this professional organization, and one of the things that we have quarreled about at great length is what qualifies a teacher. Because there's this aspect of it which is, you know, somebody could go through, all right, 10 years in the monastery and study X numbers of sutras, and they could do all the stuff, they could take all the steps and still be missing it. and somebody else, which we have to, you know, stories from our lineage tradition about this. Here's Ananda, which Kyogen talks about in the chapter, who he's the third disciple. You know, he's Shakyamuni, then there's Makakasho and Ananda. And Ananda was brilliant. He was incredibly smart. He had an eidetic memory. He could remember everything the Buddha ever said. He served the Buddha faithfully. He was kind and generous and everything. And he didn't get it. And so Makakasho became the, you know, the Dharma heir. And then Ananda, bless his heart, he studied with Makakasho. And then finally, you know, he has this exchange. Well, you know, this is according to the story. He has his exchange with Makakasho, which was basically like, what am I missing? What did you get that I didn't get? And then Makakasho basically, you know, there's this tradition, I guess, in India when two spiritual masters, or who knows, maybe anybody, was going to have a debate, they would put up two flagpoles. And, you know, whoever lost the debate would have their flagpole chopped down. So Makakasho tells Ananda, he tells him, chop down the flagpole. You know, just let go of trying to grasp this, to understand this, to achieve it. And then Ananda got it, right? So you can do all this stuff. You can jump through all the hoops. So Hosley and I get it, right? Now, what getting it means is something we could talk about. But on the other hand, then we have the story of the sixth ancestor in China who he wasn't a monk, he didn't study, he was illiterate, and he got it. He ended up being intrigued. He overheard somebody chanting a sutra, and he was like, huh. And then he was transmitted as the sixth ancestor, and he had to leave town because all the monks would be so mad that, like, who is this guy? He comes out of nowhere, and now you're going to transmit him? So anyway, there's this in Zen and in Chan in China before it was called Zen in Japan. They called it this transmission outside the scriptures, this something that is past. But, like, if you can't, if it's not about jumping through certain hoops or doing certain things or memorizing certain things, and it's just about me as the teacher recognizing it in you in some kind of esoteric way, I mean, that's... If you feel a little skeptical about every one of those exchanges over time, that is fair. So Kyogen says something about this kind of profound aspect of transmission, bottom of 163 and then on to 164. So Roshi Kenneth was saying, who transmitted Shakyamuni Buddha? He says, one answer to that question is that innate Buddha mind transmitted Shakyamuni Buddha. Buddha mind is always available and practice is always available. You can have a teacher and a center that is less than perfect. Yet if a student comes into that environment with true way-seeking mind and they receive adequate instruction in meditation and good basic dharma, innate Buddha nature responds. Way-seeking mind and a just good enough environment will respond. Such a teacher or center can cultivate a really excellent student who becomes a deeply enlightened teacher. It's foolish to think that the larger cannot come out of the smaller. How could a flawed so-so teacher have a great enlightened disciple? There's a fundamental wrong-headedness in the question. In that question, innate Buddha nature is innate Buddha nature. Who transmitted Shakyamuni Buddha? Practice is what does it. The fundamental solidity of Dharma does it. When things got kind of crazy at Shasta, the monastery he trained at, The basic structure and the basic Dharma were still good. And then a little further down, we emphasize practice more than study. Do the practice, sit, follow the breath, engage in the work. Then, when we have a sense of it in our own bodies through direct experience, study can help inform us so that we can better express it in the here and now in a correct, appropriate American way. So, there are many legitimate reasons for suspicion, I think, when it comes to this idea of lineage and reverence for ancestors and what have you. Organized religions haven't always been the most skillful and beneficial institutions. I think of groupthink or guru worship, power dynamics. Why should you need your path affirmed by somebody else? If there's a lot of ancestor worship, it could become something like other power or blind faith, or frankly, given the history of our traditions, patriarchy. I mean, how do we know whatever these old farts realized, is it still relevant? Maybe it's not even relevant to us anymore. If there's too much reverence for what has come before and the ancestors, your religion can get stale and stagnant, not changing because of attachment to and reverence to the great past. But doubt and questioning are very welcome and in our lineage, and I think most Zen lineages. As long as you're generally respectful of others, aware that some other people might have some, you know, the sense of lineage, the sense of transmission, ancestors might be meaningful to them. You know, we don't sit around and disparage that. But each of us is welcome, if we want, to completely disregard the whole ancestor thing. You know, I deliberately put our chanting service on Sundays before Zazen, so you don't have to come to it if you don't want to come to it. you know, of just avoid chanting, take stories of the ancestors with a grain of salt. Don't worry about a lack of devotion. That said, you know, why do we honor lineage? Why not just jettison this part of our tradition? So I thought of three reasons. You know, as I was preparing for this class, maybe there's more than three. The first is practical. This is a practical, if imperfect, way to protect and preserve and or conserve, to carry on our tradition. So even if that kind of profound Buddha to Buddha recognition thing is, I mean, we know at when you look at our written lineage, that's at least partly myth. We know certain ancestors never even met each other. And during certain times, transmission started to mean other things. If you became the abbot of a monastery, you were considered transmitted by the previous abbot. And, you know, there's stuff got in there. So it's not all, you know, magical Buddha meeting Buddha. But even if you set aside that profound aspect of it, people handing the Dharma down from generation to generation, requiring real understanding and manifestation, not just intellectual knowledge or empty ritual. You might think of this as an apprenticeship model, that you actually have to train with somebody at their, you know, their vocation for, you know, until that person goes, all right, you can do this on your own. Or, you know, like then there's stages, right? Okay, you can do this on your own if, as long as you're supervised. So you have to wait for a while. You have to work hard and put in your time before you're just sent out to be, you know, function independently. So there's something good about that. So it's not just about, you know, checking the boxes that I took these courses and spent this time, but that that somebody was looking after your training. Somebody, you know, is somebody is putting the word out for you. Somebody's endorsing you. If they transmit you, so it's kind of a scary thing to transmit people, basically, because once you transmit them, off they go, and you don't know what they're going to do. So I would imagine there's there have been some teachers through time who have regretted their transmissions. Yeah. Would you come up here?
Yeah. I was just curious about transmission. So when would this occur? Just when somebody was, like, old, and or would it be like they just felt like this is the person and they get it and I'm going to transmit it?
Good question. Well, you, and so a teacher can transmit multiple people. So it's kind of like a, I guess, like a river that can, you know, go off into different channels. So there's this kind of sense, we have that one lineage, but that's just because that's the particular line that goes back. Actually, you know, Great Vow, other places, they'll have a different, it'll go down basically like a family tree. It'll go down to Shakyamuni, you'll be like, oh yeah, I recognize those names. And then at a certain point, you won't recognize the names anymore because that's where the lineages diverged. So we have that one channel, but that's just because we're going backwards. Like my teachers have transmitted about, I think it's about 10 people between the two of them. So, and that can happen. Again, this is something that we've quarreled about, right? Because basically, once I am transmitted, I can choose, I could transmit you tomorrow if I wanted, right? But that wouldn't be respected very much by my peers. But it, the ironic thing is in the West, we don't really have, like in Japan, there is a structure. You would exist within a structure just like priests exist within the Catholic Church. So like, you know, you get empowered to do certain things and you have to go through certain steps and you'd have to go through certain training and blah, blah, blah. But over here, we do whatever the heck we want. Which in some ways has revitalized the tradition because, you know, the more structure you get, the more calcified things can get. But it also means there's questionable stuff going on sometimes. It's like, you know, if somebody, I don't know, I mean, there is somebody who has trained, again, I don't want to be disrespectful, but he has ordained and trained and transmitted priests online. He's never met them in person. And now I'm gaining great respect for the kind of relationships and sangha that you can build online. But there's part of me that goes like, I don't know about that part. So I don't know. It's a little, there's kind of no, so I belong to this voluntary organization of priests. And we basically are saying, and it took us forever to get out these bare minimum set of standards for training. But we all basically agree. But it's not saying that you can't be a priest if you don't meet those standards. It's just you can't be a member of our organization if you don't meet those standards. And they can go, I don't care about being a member of your organization. So it's kind of funny. I don't know. Yeah, Shaitsoki, did you have something?
When you say Kyogen and Gyokoko have transmitted about 10 people, transmitted as what? As priests, as senseis, as what?
So
because there are all these different steps.
Yes, so they there are, I think I think there were four or five of us who were ordained as priests, and at Dharma, through Dharma Rain, we had to do like 5 years of training, and so we each did our junior training and practiced for about 5 more years as well. So after about 10 years, we were transmitted as priests. But they also had lay students who practiced, you know, did what I'm calling Zaike Tokudo. They call them lay disciples. And they practiced for many, many years. And there's several of those who were transmitted as lay teachers. So they have the same, it's acknowledging the same level of realization of qualifications to teach the Dharma. The only thing that they can't do is ordain priests, because they didn't train as priests. So yeah, that's the story there.
Well, does Dharma Rain have senseis and steps beyond priests?
No, we just have the transmitted and no. So there is this practical aspect to it, which is, it's an imperfect thing, but it's better than nothing. So the basic thing is, for yourself and for others, if you are going to go to a Buddhist center, Zen center, Buddhist center, if you are going to, you know, study with a teacher, go to a retreat with a teacher, you're really impressed by their writing, something, you want to research their lineage. If you go to their website and they do not mention anything about lineage, that's, I'm not saying that they're not legit, and I'm not saying that they're not maybe great teachers or something, but from the Buddhist and Zen point of view, that's like, so why wouldn't, that's like a doctor hiding where they went to medical school or got their degree from or something. It's like, where did you come from? I want to know where you came from, right? So you want to know where the lineage comes from. And then, you know, there's certain lineages that are pretty well known. And if it's not a lineage that's well known, then you ask somebody like me and you go, have you ever heard of the, you know, such and such? And I'm like, oh yeah, I think so. So there's just this sense of, particularly in the West, that it's not a strict and absolute thing, but there's a normative quality to all of us maintaining these relationships, these lineage relationships, these cross, you know, so these other Dharma Rain teachers, maintaining relationships with them, so that we're not just out there as mavericks, just doing our own thing. Because things, you know, we know, things can go off the rails, and you want peers, you want professional organizations that can say that's not cool, knock it off. So that is the practical aspect. So one of my podcast on episode 95 on lineage, I talked about how lineage isn't just about making sure a particular tradition survives more or less intact over time. There's also a benefit to the training of an individual when they practice aligning themselves with a lineage. So I gave it a definition of the lineage. Lineage is a vital place of intersection between the individual practitioner and the collective tradition. So many people are fond of quoting the Buddha's, one of his last things he said was, be lamps unto yourselves. Which, yes, and ultimately, we have to do our own practice. Only we know, you know, where we are. Only we really know our own hearts and minds. So we have to be lamps unto ourselves and take refuge in Sangha. So a couple other well-known pieces. This is from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha is called the Blessed One. Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is the half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." The Buddha responds, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." And then Thich Nhat Hanh said that in his tradition, people say that when a tiger leaves the mountain and goes to the lowland, it will be caught by humans and killed. When practitioners leave their sangha, they will abandon their practice after a few months. So this is your practice and no one can do it for you, and you can't do it alone. I mean, you can do some of it alone. you can study, you can meditate. So really, there's plenty of stuff that you can do alone. But this whole path of transformation, you might even be capable of awakening to certain things on your own. But that's not the whole piece. The whole piece of really being remade by this path takes people. There's a saying that says anybody can feel enlightened on a mountaintop. But it's with other human beings that we are challenged and supported and seen and manifest. We have to test our ability to manifest this together. We have to test our ability to express it to one another, or not have to, but that's part of the tools of the tradition. And also when we encounter things, so this you know, individual meets the collective tradition. Now, almost all of us here are converts to Buddhism, and many of us come with some baggage and some suspicion when it comes to collective traditions because of negative experiences or whatever. So there's a little like, I don't know about a collective tradition, and kind of, but there's something. So it has lots of pros and cons, but there is something really powerful about a collective tradition. About, you know, I guess I think of New Age in a disparaging way is basically you just pick and choose from various spiritual things what suits you, what you find helpful and what suits you, which, you know, I guess no harm done. But what you're going to tend to do then is to leave out the stuff that is kind of, you know, not immediately obvious, difficult to understand, challenging. Teachings perhaps like no self that are like, that sounds like a bummer. I don't want to deal with that. Or other sangha members or certain parts of our form that rub you the wrong way, and then you have to just do it and you have to find out why it rubs you the wrong way. And there's this richness in the tradition that is part of the value of belonging to a collective tradition. We don't have to swallow it all, we don't have to believe it all, we don't have to like it all. But if we surrender enough of our self-concern to respectfully align ourselves, we become an integral part of something bigger, something collectively held, something that is created anew and then can be also shared with others. So this is something that, you know, I've really felt like my inclination when I am in spiritual need is to see if I can at all possible find the answer within Soto Zen or the larger Buddhist picture. The like the Buddhist, you know, the family tree going back to Shakyamuni. Not because I think other traditions aren't it, but because as a teacher, I want to be able to offer this tradition. I don't, the you know, if you came to me and I'm like, well, I've found that doing Aikido is great, and I found that, you know, this other, you know, tradition is great, this other, you know, exercise is great. We don't hold as much collectively then. Whereas if we, you know, so it's a balance, because we want innovation, we want to do things that are appropriate for this environment, but also trying to stay grounded in the collective tradition. So we have something in common when we go to a different Soto Zen center, or a different Zen center, or even a different Buddhist center. We have something in common. So I thought Kyogen said something sweet about this on page 165. The wisdom of Buddhism always is collectively created in the present. Shakyamuni is transmitted by all the successive Dharma ancestors. So he's talking about how lineage flows both ways. There's numerous, you know, Buddha meets Buddha, right? And the teacher-student thing. It's like it's not a top-down thing. It's a horizontal recognition. Right down to this present moment. When we do this practice and experience it in our own bodies and minds, we transmit Shakyamuni Buddha. The form creates our experience, but we give life to it. The Dharma supports us and through study helps direct the mind in a certain way. It transmits to us, but this goes the other way also. When we express it, we hold it and manifest the Dharma. We are creating it. So, how about teachers, though, versus other Sangha members? So this is definitely an aspect of our lineage. Like I said, people who get it and then pass it on to others who get it. And then those who get it get to sit in the teacher's seat. You know, what is this? So this whole setup causes various reactions in people. I mean, some people love the idea and look forward to participating in the system. That sounds cool. I'd like a teacher. That's great. Some are deeply mistrustful, suspecting the whole thing is just like shallow and ego-based and ripe for abuse of power, which it can be. Some, kind of like myself, have a love-hate relationship with it, experiencing some longing and envy, fascination and frustration, constantly wondering, like, where do I, you know, relate to the whole? Because it kind of suggests that there's measurement and comparison. And then I'm sure there's many people who just see it as irrelevant. So once again, we are aiming for the middle way. And the extremes here would be, I suppose, I don't need a teacher. I don't need someone to tell me what to do. I don't need to need somebody to tell me if what I'm doing is right or wrong. I don't need somebody to approve or disapprove. And the other extreme is I need a teacher, someone to tell me what to do, tell me if what I'm doing is right or wrong, somebody to approve or disapprove. So what's the third option? The middle way is not just in between those two, not on the fence, but just a not getting stuck in the extremes. And basically, I get to say, we slowly, cautiously, courageously explore what our lineage has to offer, testing it for ourselves, seeing what is there to be learned. I think in many ways, in modern Zen communities, the Sangha is is more of the teacher than the teacher. Just participating in the practice together is the most instructive thing, and that over time we get to know and see one another. Buddha recognizing Buddha sounds dramatic, right? Like one day you're going to walk in and we're going to be like, oh, there it is. You've got it. But this mostly happens over time as we meet one another in work and in discussion, in the midst of volunteer roles, in ceremony, during life transitions. And then I and other Sangha members, we watch people's transformation over time as they become more comfortable in their own skin, less fearful, with more energy and attention to turn toward others, and yet with a calm sense of ease. I know that when I felt like I've said before about the, you know, awakening, that this can be like kind of, there can be dramatic experiences, but that for most of us, it's like the flower blooms slowly and we hardly notice until there it is. Or the other analogy is walking in the midst of mist, and you don't even necessarily notice you're getting wet, and then you're soaked through. So that's what it was like for me. But I kind of, when I started to make that shift over into like, okay, I think I'm starting to get this, that I felt like my focus turned from here outward. It's like, because my suffering and pain and neurosis and fear was relieved so much, I was like, it's kind of like, hey, wow, look at all these people. look at this world. Like, it, so it wasn't a like, now I'm going to be so generous and whatever. It was just, I wasn't so consumed with my own pain that I just had more attention paid elsewhere. So I just wanted to finish up with the third reason. So that was the practical and then the benefit to the individual, but also, I guess this is another benefit to the individual, but opening to gratitude, to humility, to the enormity of what we have received with the three treasures, with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. If you, you know, having been able to encounter the Dharma, having been able to be taught how to meditate, having been able to be taught, you know, how to just be mindful in your daily life, the support of Sangha, whatever it is that has supported you, that this has come into your life, and that it couldn't have come into your life without the work and generosity of many, many beings. And my own experience of this, it's interesting. So when I recite, so this kind of goes into the second chapter that Kyogen on the women ancestors. I hadn't particularly connected with the line, our traditional lineage. In part because I was aware that many of these men in this lineage, if they had met me at the time, wouldn't even have taught me. They wouldn't even have thought I was worth it, let alone, you know, be a full independent teacher. So that kind of sucks. I mean, I can still think they're brilliant. And frankly, several of them, like Dogen did have female students and he transmitted female students. But that was a, you know, a little bit like, all right, I guess, but I've known that these guys really intended to hand this down to me. And then, you know, it's noticeable that there's like 85 names and only the last one is a woman. Only Roshi Kennett is a woman. But noticeably, in our lineage, so you don't get added to the lineage until you die. So my teacher's still alive, but when she dies, and then when I die, there will be three women's names at the end of that list. Anyway, there was a there's a ceremony called the Ananshiki, which we don't really know how to do in the West, but it's done in Japan, and it's done by nuns. It's done by ordained Soto Zen women. And it's like a kind of a, I mean, it's not secret that it happens, but it's just the women are there, and they don't like broadcast the details of this ceremony. So I got to participate in a abbreviated version of this at a training that I went to many years ago. And in it, we are thanking two people. We're thanking Mahapajapati, the Buddha's aunt, and the first, according to the myth, the first nun. So she and her daughter-in-law and all kinds of women were following the Buddha around and insisted on being ordained. And the Buddha said no. And they said, so he kept on saying no. And in part, he was trying to, you know, to give him the benefit of the doubt. He was trying to protect a brand new, already radical religious tradition that involved home leaving. And if he was encouraging people's wives to leave, they probably would have gotten a lot of flack. So anyway, he was saying no. But then Ananda, so this is the third, right, the very sweet ancestor that took a while to get it. So he says to the Buddha, like, but you say all beings can be enlightened, all beings have the potential for awakening, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. And the Buddha says, yeah. He's like, so why won't you ordain the women? And so he keeps at Shakyamuni until finally Shakyamuni says yes. So this ceremony is thanking Mahapajapati and Ananda. And when I did this ceremony, I mean, I am not a devotional person naturally. I am not like, but there was something when we women were standing together and we were thanking Mahapajapati and Ananda, you know, that it was gratitude for the opportunity to be ordained. You know, whether Ananda or Mahapajapati ever existed, I owed this to beings. I owed this to beings who also said women can do this too. And I just, just weeping and weeping through this whole ceremony. But it was one of the first times that I really, really had that heart sense of connection to ancestors and lineage and this sense of this great gift that I had been given. And then, you know, for my own teacher, I feel absolutely, I feel like she gave me my life. And not because she gave me some advice that, you know, magically opened doors for me, or I guess she was just there. She was just there as a rock while I went through my stuff and had faith in me and had faith in the practice. And that was enough. I wouldn't have had the courage to do all of it on my own. So that's immense, immense gratitude. So, I guess we have only 5 minutes, but I guess I'll leave it there. See if we have any questions or comments. Oh, will you come up?
Oh. When I read the first chapter there, it makes it sound so easy. You know, just one day, it's like one day you just finally saw it, or your perception shifted or something. I mean, but you know, honestly, it was helpful. because, you know, you read stories about people becoming enlightened, but what happened? Anyway, it kind of made sense to me, so it was helpful.
At one point, I wish I had it with me, but I wrote this poem, and I would say that at this point, the point that I wrote this poem, I perceived myself as on the I haven't gotten it yet side, right? Because you should never, honestly, you really should never think you're on the other side of I got it, right? Like, you're like, it's like, because it's not an either or thing. But as he was talking about this sense of like, you, how did he phrase it? Like, you turned inside out, or what was it? He said, a turning moment when your being is turned inside out. And again, like I said, it's not necessarily a moment, but there is a pivotal point where I guess we see where we line up with all this stuff. Us, our being, our self, this self, how it also partakes of all of this. Because you can kind of like, all right, I kind of get Buddha nature and all of that, but how does that relate to me? And then when we essentially awaken to our own true nature, everything's different after that. Because we're not, I don't know, yeah, we're freed from a sense of existential angst. That's a real drag. We have still have a lot to learn, a lot to wake up to, but it's like that piece of ourselves is freed. But I perceived when I wrote this poem, I perceived that I was before that point, right? And it was like, how did I phrase it? It was like, you can't get rid of this stuff, this idea, this talk about awakening and these turning moments. And some people are teachers and some people aren't. And you can kind of like, as long as you're going to participate in the tradition, even if you're like, I don't care that much about that stuff, like, it's still there. I said, it's like a mosquito in the night. Like, you can't ignore it. And yet you can't really understand it either. You can't really make sense of it. So it's just a kind of uncomfortable thing that we live with. But I appreciate that. I appreciate that tension, because it just keeps on reminding us there's something more. There's something more. But it's not there's something more and therefore we are inadequate. It's there's something more. So, you know, because we didn't have any of that stuff. Just imagine what it would be like if you just came here and we talked about meditation, we talked about mindfulness and precepts and, you know, and you just did the best you could and, you know, reduced some stress in your life. I mean, that'd be okay, right? No harm done. But there's this extra piece, which is like, what? which is pulling us to something deeper. All right, that's the end. Thank you all for being here. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.